The ink really hasn't dried off the 2019 class. We're already getting into 2020 this next weekend, but we hope you pretend we're football for the next hour. I am your host, Will Bays, and I'm joined alongside by Johnny Brashear and Tim Preston. You guys are listening to the Hornscast channel, which you can find anywhere you can find a podcast. Today we're going to be going over the games against Baylor, West Virginia, and K-State, give you our quick thoughts on it, and break down the stretch of games as a whole. Then go into the home stretch of Texas as they have six more games left on the schedule, tell you how many wins we think Texas ends off with, what it takes to get Texas in the tournament, and what's the worst case scenario we can envision. But before we get into that, let's go ahead and do our pretend you're getting to know us. And this week's theme is going over something that's lighting up social media. Aladdin's teaser trailer just dropped. And now we have a glimpse of Will Smith taking on our beloved Blue Genie after the death of Robin Williams. So we're tasked to helm the next Disney remake. Which animated childhood classic would you choose to adapt, and how would you ruin everyone else's childhood?
Yeah, mine almost for sure is going to be the lamest. I'm having a hard time thinking about this. When we were talking off the air, one of the things that both Johnny and I were remarking about is that I remember watching like Disney classics like Snow White or Cinderella or Bambi, like not really giving too much of a shit, but like the stuff from my childhood that was really popular was like was not animated, like the Mighty Ducks, or you know some other stuff kind of like that. The Program, not animated, but so there wasn't a whole lot of like great animated films from my childhood that have not already been redone, right? So Lion King is already coming out, Beauty and the Beast, and now Aladdin. But I think there's a case to be made that perhaps the most iconic character in Disney lore is Snow White. And so I think that they should just cast Paris Hilton as Snow White, as this virtuous, lovely, she you know has a great relationship with animals, things like that.
Dyed her hair black.
Yeah, South Park already did that.
Okay, fair enough. But yeah, I guess taking someone who should be kind of virtuous and casting this just a really tremendous skank in that. So, which is
Pamela
a you know just, yeah
Snow
yes.
White.
Tail as old as time, cooch as big as earth. I don't know for whatever, but yeah. So that I guess that's mine. Shortest pretend you're getting to know us that you're gonna have from the Timster.
What about you, Johnny? What do you think?
So I decided that I would I'd pick Peter Pan because it's I mean it's been remade but so is pretty much every Disney movie at this point I think so the thing I'm going to do because if you're gonna ruin people's childhood you don't really do it halfway. There's no such thing as a halfway crook when it comes to ruining childhoods. So I decided that in this case. When Peter Pan takes the kids to Neverland, Neverland is not actually a fantasy realm, but the name of the dungeon where he keeps all the children he steals. And the rest of the movie is just sort of a, you know, Saw type movie where it's
9mm.
Get out.
Yeah. Like it's like 8mm where you're just
8mm.
It's just children snuff films over and over again. There's,
God
it's like
damn
they,
it, Johnny. That's
they show up in Neverland and they realize that it's too late. It's over. There's no escaping this. Like
God
there's
damn.
There's no Captain Hook. There's a literal hook. It's just
Rufio. Where? Yeah. Oh, Rufio. Right. There's plenty of Rufio.
Tinkerbell is like a 6'4", 300-pound dude in the corner.
Oh man, this is really bad. Yeah. This is really fucking bad. Oh god.
Just this, so everyone is aware, you're getting a glimpse into the true Johnny right now, right? He is not the altruistic, thoughtful person that he portrays elsewhere. He's a sick bastard.
He's worse than he's portrayed online, and that's where I'm pretty bad. All right.
Yeah. So Will, you?
Oh, man, I don't know how I'm going to follow that one up. So I
fucking say something, Will. Anything.
I'm gonna go ahead and cheat here. I have three different ones. So wow. The first one would be remake of Song of the South, which is been criticized as Disney's most racist piece of work out there. So bad that they have a ride in Disney World about it, but you can find it nowhere else. I mean, it's really bad. So basically, I'm going to do a different way. What's up?
What ride is that? I've been there a couple times.
It's the Waterlog ride.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to take
Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. You just really got to look at the subtle. You know, there's a lot of implications.
Are they beating a black person over there?
But I'm going to go ahead and take everybody's favorite actors from like the 90s and cast them in this movie. And one of them has to wear blackface to be Uncle Remus. So just a cherry on top. So like Tom Hanks, Leonardo DiCaprio, Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt, Keanu Reeves, Johnny Depp, Matt Damon. All these people have to be in the movie. One of them has to play a rabbit. The other one has to wear blackface. Jim Carrey.
We need Tom Hanks in blackface more than I can describe. Like, he's by all accounts one of the nicest humans in Hollywood.
Exactly.
But man, that would be some shit.
Same thing with Keanu Reeves. Apparently one of the nicest
people
in Hollywood.
See him trying to pull that off. Like, you know, weren't you Sully? What the hell, man?
And then the next one would be uber realistic Mickey Mouse movie. Have Mickey Mouse have the same general makeup, but make him look like what the Sonic movie is going to look like, but for Mickey Mouse. If y'all know what I'm talking about, where they tried to make Sonic look like a realistic hedgehog, but also kind of look like what he does in the video games. Do that for Mickey Mouse.
So you're saying like Mickey Mouse, but he looks like one of the Skeksis from Dark Crystal or something?
Yes.
Dark Crystal.
Yes. So just a really, really bad looking Mickey Mouse because they tried to get realistic with it.
Like it's Mickey Rat. That's what happened. We turned him into Mickey Rat.
And then the last one would be one of my favorite characters in any Disney movie was Mushu from Mulan. So I would replace Mushu, his voice actor, with Adam Sandler. So have Adam Sandler voice Mushu in Mulan.
Is Mushu Eddie Murphy?
Eddie Murphy, yeah.
Okay.
God, I wish I could do an Adam Sandler impression of him doing Mushu.
Touch the Mulan? Yeah. That's pretty much it.
That's a good one.
Your family will care about you.
But yeah, I think from there, I'm having trouble today. But I think from there, let's go ahead and get into the actual meat of the show and talk about Baylor, West Virginia, and Kansas State. Just as disappointing a revelation at the very end as the Aladdin teaser trailer with Will Smith being Genie, that was Baylor, West Virginia looked really good, and then Kansas State just the very end killed it. Very end killed it. I mean, it kind of feels like Texas, the basketball program, is gaslighting us. Like, we have an abusive relationship with Texas athletics, but we keep on coming back because we love it so. But it's bad. It's bad. So go ahead and give me your quick thoughts on Baylor. Coming out of Baylor, how did you feel about this program, and what were your just quick thoughts on the game?
Well, I was happy because anytime Baylor loses, it's a good day, especially when they get pretty much pummeled. So I enjoyed that. It was a nice team win all around. And there weren't a lot of complaints of that other than maybe, you know, make a couple more free throws towards the end to keep it a 20-point beatdown. But beyond that, yeah, that was pretty much an all-around good victory.
That was heartening for me because that was one of the first times, really kind of seemingly since Shaka's first year, that we have attacked a zone with dribble penetration. We don't flash people to the high post against zone. We don't do that, really. I guess we used to do it a little bit with Jarrett, but we didn't really have anyone that could penetrate like we do now his year. But we attacked over and over to the center of the lane with penetration. And so that was exciting to see us do that. Not just like throwing a wrinkle with that, but that was our offense against their zone. And it felt like they made Baylor change their defense seemingly like a dozen times. You know, one time they'd be in 1-3-1, then they'd be 2-3, then they'd go to man, then they'd be back in 1-3-1, and so they just couldn't find the answers for us on their defensive end. So I was excited to watch us really attack in that way.
And it kind of continued on to West Virginia, right, where Texas looked pretty darn good over in Morgantown, which is kind of difficult to do. I mean, it's hard to play anywhere in the Big 12 as an away team, and Texas took it to West Virginia pretty early and very often.
Yeah, I thought so too. And actually, like, that's historically, those are games under Shaka that we lose, right? Like, we keep on throwing up some stinkers against team that we should beat. And I think that there is probably a little bit of a stigma about Texas in the last few years of like, all right, well, if you can hang in with them, if you can get close towards the end of the games, like we can take them down. But I thought Texas really wore out West Virginia, and like we kind of snuffed out any hope that they might have, to the point where I want to say they dismissed, like they got rid of Issa Ahmad, and then one other guy like got dismissed from the team. I want to say within the next 24 hours or so after that.
Yep.
So to watch Texas not only win but also kind of steal the heart from somebody was very gratifying. It was nice to see them. Hey, they should beat West Virginia easily. They did. And that was a nice change of pace for us, because
they did that thing in Indiana Jones where you stick your hand in the chest and you pull out the beating heart and you take a bite.
You have a trade, Shiva.
Yeah, it was. You know, one of the things that Tim mentioned in the last podcast, I think it was, is that Texas needs to take care of the teams they're supposed to take care of, because those have been the games that they've sort of, this year, have been the ones that they tend to fall short, is the ones where they are a decided favorite and they don't quite, you know, put their boot on a throat, as it were. And in this game, they absolutely did it. They probably took one of Bob Huggins's 5 years left off his life in that game, because, you know, I've never seen Huggins that still during a game as he was in the second half, because he just sort of gave up. I think he's sort of given up on this season in general. But it's, you know, if we're looking for things that are different than earlier this year, taking it to West Virginia as opposed to what they did against, you know, Oklahoma State or Radford or some of these other teams, is a sign that maybe this team is heading in the direction we want them to head. And so, more than the dunk fest, more than watching Morgantown empty out, the fact that Texas took care of business and in a serious manner against West Virginia is what I liked out of that game.
That actually kind of did feel to me like the beginning of the end for him there. Like, I would not be surprised if Huggins is no longer the coach there at the end of next season. It felt like that to me.
Hot take. That's a hot take.
We'll see.
Well,
I don't know.
Yeah, I don't. I've heard, you know, conflicting things about that. But I do think that if next year is not significantly better, he's going to have some pretty good heat on him. So.
But kind of what of a gut punch for West Virginia fans then, Dana Holgorsen, then Huggins.
Well, except I don't know that they wanted Dana to leave, and they may want Huggins to leave. So might be
weird,
less
though,
a gut
too, because he took them to the Final Four that, you know, whatever, like a decade ago. Like, he took them to the Final Four when they were in the Big East. He had that nice run with Javon Carter that, you know, when he was around. But yeah, it's just the dichotomous nature of him there has been pretty crazy. Like, they've either been really, really damn good or fucking terrible.
And let me try to hold on to this last shred of West Virginia as long as I possibly can, holding us away from going to Kansas State. And what was your favorite dunk out of the eight against West Virginia? And I feel like it's pretty obvious which one was the favorite, the crowd pleaser.
Yeah, Ramey on the run from Roach.
Yeah. That was, I do think that Kerwin Roach's dunk over their big man was sneaky, underappreciated. But,
yeah.
I mean, Courtney Ramey with that one-handed jam was absolutely disrespectful to the entire crowd of West Virginia. Like,
yeah, all 800 fans who were left were not happy.
Yeah, the coming out party for Ramey in that game was palpable. And I think that, like, what's been cool about him the last 3 weeks or so is you see him just like adding another layer to his game. Oh, I can do this. Oh, I can do that. Because what was it, a week ago or 2 weeks ago when we had our podcast, we talked about, well, Ramey can't get in the lane. Well, apparently he can. Like, he actually added that in the last like three
games.
He's
a listener. Listener number eight.
You know, what's up, Courtney? And I'm pretty sure he is actually, I think he's leading the team right now in 3-point percentage. So like not just.
He was going into Kansas State. I'm not sure if he still is, but if he's not, he's real close.
I would think so, because Ramey was only like 1-for-4 or something like that. I don't think, or that Febres was like 1-for-4. I don't think.
One for six, and Ramey was.
Yeah,
five for
right.
Six.
Right now he is. Yes. He's so, 39%, and Febres is 36.
That was cool because it kind of like seemed for a while as if, okay, is Ramey going to turn the corner? Is he going to turn the corner? And then in that game, not only did he shoot very well, but like, oh, and I can do this too, bitches. You know, and Shaka trusts me to be our best on-ball defender. And, you know, I take care of the ball or whatever. So it was neat to see him showcase, like, I'm the complete package, guys.
Whose team will this be next year, Ramey's or Coleman's?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure.
Yeah, very interesting.
My sense is I would say Ramey, just because Coleman tends to be a more of a get-along guy than this has to be my team or else. But I don't know. We'll see.
Because right now the team is built to be, at least in Shaka's eyes, Coleman's team. However, as you said, yeah, Ramey is the guy who I feel like will be the one who says, I don't know, I'm going to take this over. It's my job.
That's interesting, because I would agree with you, except for he keeps on taking the ball out of Coleman's hands. Like, how many games this whole season has Matt been the actual primary playmaker?
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, you're right, Will, and maybe, like, that's us. That, but what you're talking about might be us kind of projecting what we would assume would be true about Shaka with this. But, like, for the last four or five games, whenever Ramey is in the ball game, he's the guy bringing the ball up the floor. He's the guy who's initiating the offense. And I think that Shaka knows, like a lot of people do, that if you have a truly capable, diverse skill set combo guard, those guys run college basketball. Like, that's who wins college basketball games at the highest level. And so it's going to be interesting for me to see, like, that's Ramey. Like, that's what he, I think, aspires to and what his skill set suggests. The only real question for me is going to be, how good is Jace next year? Like, how high of a percentage is he able to shoot? What other wrinkles to his game does he add? What, if anything, do we get from Andrew Jones? So there's some question marks for me as far as, like, do we see Courtney's usage or the way that he, the other people who are vying for that same thing that he's able to bring. So it could be Matt's, because, like, no one else really does what Matt does. We don't have anyone that can penetrate like Matt can. We don't have anyone that can kind of like, pass in sort of the same way that Matt does. But Courtney might have some different options around him that kind of accomplish some of the same things, depending on what Andrew's capable of doing. So that will be interesting for me to see, as far as, you know, what does our makeup look like? What does the lineup look like? And who's playing at that level?
You know, I think if I'm going through this, I'm going to say that the lesson, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't project what the lesson Shaka learned from the last couple seasons is, but I feel like what his recruiting strategy has been the last couple seasons has been, you cannot have too many good ball handling guards on the floor at any given time. And so I don't know that he's going to make one guy, like, I'm sure when he recruited Coleman, he was like, that's going to be my guy, because for very understandable reasons. But now it seems like he is more interested in having 2 to 3 good ball handling guards or wings on the floor at the same time. So it's not one ball dominant dude like it was. So I don't know if it's going to be just one guy's team next year. I could see it being sort of a load-sharing agreement between Coleman and Ramey and, you know, maybe Andrew Jones or whoever else. So maybe from, like, I don't know, an emotional leader standpoint, maybe it's Coleman's team or maybe it's Ramey's team. But from an actual gameplay standpoint, I don't know that one guy is going to be the guy all the time.
It's interesting because you get into the next game, Kansas State. You know, again, talk about gut punches, talk about teaser trailers. The first two games were the beginning of the teaser trailer, and then this game was the reveal of Will Smith being Genie, because the very end, just everything fell apart. You had a really good run coming off of the embarrassing loss of Georgia for Texas. You beat Kansas. You almost beat Iowa State at their house. You beat Baylor, who was number two in the conference. You whooped up on West Virginia. You did what you're supposed to do. And you have Kansas State on the ropes. And all of a sudden, everything just falls apart. And Texas ends up missing everything from three. Well, shooting threes to begin with. They end off with only two players shooting, getting double-digit points, whereas Kansas had their all five of their starters get double-digit points. It was just everything fell apart. What happened there? I mean, you know, there's obviously people pointing to Courtney Ramey not being on the floor for the last, what was it, 6 minutes. But what happened?
I guess I'm not so concerned about the only two guys being in double figures because the next three guys all scored nine. So, right. You know, each of them gets one more point, and we're like, well, we had five guys score double digits too. My issues were, like, I'm not bothered by the Courtney Ramey benching because he was not being a good teammate, shall we say. His blood runs a little hot sometimes, and he went a little ape shit. And you know, if he's going to do that to coaches or to, you know, all of his other teammates, then yeah, he's going to get sat, and he should. It sucks that he was sat, although the way he was playing, it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like he was 5 of 6 from three and they sat.
One of five.
Yeah, he was 1 of 5. He had one assist in 28 minutes. He had some rebounds and he was penetrating early in the game. So, you know, he was doing some positive things. I don't want to paint it in an entirely negative light here, but, you know, that part doesn't bother me. What concerns me more is I understand the desire to get the ball out of Dean Wade's hands. And it's a defensible strategy because he is the best player on Kansas State's team right now. The problem is that if you double him constantly and it's a predictable double, he's a good passer. And if you are doubling him hard and you're not rotating properly on defense, you are going to have guys open on the perimeter, outside of the lane, and Wade can find them because he is still a 6'10 dude who knows how to pass.
So you're saying Texas really didn't have a backup strategy or a plan B once plan A was figured out?
Well, I mean, they also tried zone, and that had some that worked in limited moments. You know, it wasn't perfect, but it was okay. They tried pressure, which worked sometimes and didn't some other times. So, I mean, they tried some other things. But it did seem like their strategy was, okay, don't let Dean Wade beat us. And, you know, in terms of scoring, he didn't. He wasn't overwhelming the team or anything. The downside is that he is a good enough passer that he had, I think, 6 assists on the night. He was very effective passing out of that double team. And I would have, you know, in hindsight, preferred to see them play him straight up a little more if it meant that they were going to be more solid on their defense elsewhere. The offense, I'm not as concerned about because, you know, sometimes you shoot well from three and sometimes you don't. They did really well against Kansas State's man defense in the first half. Their zone offense is a problem, as it has been a problem all year, and that's a bigger source of concern than just about anything else for me.
I guess I will take the exact opposite from that game. So for me,
well then, fuck you, Tim.
Yeah, man, big time. That's legit.
This is why I do this. I like seeing you guys box.
So
well, fuck
I actually...
you too, Will. All right, how about that? I got two hands. You both can each come see one of them.
Got a point.
Dez and Troy. Yeah. You put them together, they destroy. So this is going to sound weird considering how well Kansas State shot. I don't think Texas played poor defense yesterday. Kansas State shot out of character from three.
What a theme for the season. Yeah. Blank team with blank player who has not really been good at shooting over the entire year had a lights out game against Texas.
Yeah. Kansas State has a guy with no thumbs and he shot 6 of 8 from three. He's now 6 of 96 from three on the season. Yeah.
So I thought that they made Kansas State. I mean, I can count it just in my memory. I can count 3 or 4 very tough mid-range shots that Kansas State hit. They obviously shot pretty well from three. That's a bit of an understatement, of course. But I don't think we played poorly defensively. I don't like the wrinkle, as Johnny said. I don't like the wrinkle of helping off of Dean. I thought that we could have done a little bit more with Jackson and Jericho on Dean and making him hit some tough shots. In fact, I want to say he airballed at least one shot and missed a couple other shots where we contested him well. So I wasn't crazy concerned defensively, because sometimes teams that have the kind of veteran leadership that they have are just going to hit tough shots. And I, you know, there was a lot of times where I felt like we defended them about as well as we could, and they still hit some good shots. Offensively, where I struggled was a few things. The first is, this is not some kind of like initial time that we've seen zone. We've seen zone a shit ton, and good teams that have even kind of competent coaches are gonna zone us. What I really despised is that a couple of games ago against Baylor, we attacked their zone consistently. Like, we were over and over getting into the lane, making them guard us on dribble penetration through their zone. And because they couldn't do it, we hurt them over and over. And we just didn't do that in the second half. We were not probing with the dribble. We were not getting into the lane. We were not taking kind of like, you know, never taking no for an answer or whatever it might be. And I think that Kerwin, I think, had something like 14 points in the first half or so, and 10 of them were at the rim. He had 1 point in the second half, or sorry, 2 points in the second half at the rim. Courtney didn't get any points in the lane in the second half. We kept on trying to, you know, do that same kind of lob to Jackson, which he converted 0 times. He had no lob dunks yesterday, at least not from Roach, at least. And it felt like we were playing to our tendencies, but not to what Kansas State was giving us in zone. Like a good defensive team can take things away from you, and we struggled to kind of take the action to them where they were giving it to us, and we were like, oh, we'll just do this. We're like, yeah, we know you do that, so we're going to play to that tendency, and we couldn't make them pay.
So let's go ahead and take all of these games and crunch them together, and I'm going to ask you all 3 questions. The first being, what from these games is replicable and needs to be replicated again over the next 6 games of the season?
So we're talking about the last 3 games, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So I would say what's replicable is attacking the paint. Like, they have shown in just about every game. I mean, most of the games in the last half of the season, they've shown that they have the ability to attack the paint. So I think they can attack the paint against pretty much anyone, especially because other than Baylor, most of the other teams don't play a lot of zone. So that seems like the most, I'm going to call it, easily replicable thing that they've got going.
That's the answer. They have to attack. When we attack, we are a very different offense than if we don't. If we're content passing on the perimeter and looking for like straight driving angles, like, that's not there. Like, it's not going to happen. Teams don't have to play us that way. So we have to force the issue. They must get into the lane as consistently as possible, whether that's, you know, finding the pick and slip with Jackson, or whether that's, you know, getting the ball to Dylan where he can kind of have those lane sweeps and get across or back someone down, or more likely whether it's Matt or Courtney or Kerwin just getting into the lane off the bounce. We have to do that.
Yeah, and I think that to Tim's point, it doesn't mean finish at the rim. It can mean finish at the rim, but I think they need to attack the paint partly because it gets into the rim, partly because it opens up lobs, partly because it opens up 3-point shots. So attacking the paint is sort of the central strategy of this offense, and I think that's you know, it unlocks everything else.
Right. When they attack the paint, you can see the offense really start to open up and everything starts to work. The next question being, what was surprising out of these past 3 games in a good or bad way? Can it happen again?
I've been surprised at how well we've rebounded. I I thought as conference play went on, and especially as our rotation is kind of has dwindled, and we've seen a lot of Jace at the four. I could, if you told me that we're gonna play, you know, probably at least 5 to 7 minutes a game with Jace at the four, that we're gonna see this team really struggle rebounding wise, and we've been pretty good. So I've been pleased with that. I think that we can obviously. Jackson has a ways to go as a rebounder. We can team rebound better on defense than we have, but I think that we've been okay, and that gives me a lot of heart. Like there's a reason that we're staying in games even if we're not shooting well. There's a reason we're staying in games even if our opponent is shooting really well. And so the fact that we've been able to kind of figure that out has been heartening. So if that truly is the case, if our rebounding is going to be decent enough to at least like almost break even or be close to breaking even, that's a piece that I'm glad that we can apparently rely on, because I was nervous about that a week or 2 weeks ago.
The surprising thing to me was the way they were able to dominate multiple opponents in a row. I don't know if they can dominate games like that against some of the upcoming teams, because this is a relatively easy part of the Big 12 schedule for them. I mean, relatively being the carrying some heavy lifting there. But I think if they can take that same mentality, that same sort of consistent approach they've taken, because, you know, you go back as far as from the Georgia game, there is now four, and I'm going to call it 4.5 out of 5 games where they had a consistent energy and effectiveness on both ends of the floor. Like they played 4.5 games as a top 25 team. And, you know, you see them starting to get votes in the polls and stuff. So other people are recognizing that they're starting to do something. So if they're going to do something if they're going to surprise me, they're going to be consistent. And so being consistent at that sort of level going forward would do a lot to help their postseason hopes.
Okay. And the last question, what needs to be fixed immediately coming out of these games?
I still think it's the zone offense. I mean, I don't know if it can be fixed immediately, but it should get the primary attention from them. Even if they can just develop a couple wrinkles here and there that are effective, just enough to get people out of the zone, that would be good. Because their offense is performing well enough against most man defenses that I'm not concerned about that in terms of execution and getting open shots. But until they start showing that they can score against the zone reliably, they're going to see a lot of it.
Well, if your question of what needs to be fixed is how do we maximize the next 6 games, to me it's we can't be sitting here in 3 weeks or 4 weeks and asking what the hell was Kerwin doing over that stretch. Or what was he thinking over that half of basketball? And to watch him play so brilliantly, I mean, just brilliantly in the first half against Kansas State, and then you look at him in the second half and say, like, what was that? Like, what were you doing? We cannot absorb that. Like, it just seems so clear. We can absorb Dylan being Dylan, you know, down low and not converting. We can absorb Jackson having some foul trouble. We can absorb, you know, Courtney kind of being a crazy person and, you know, 1 second being awesome and the next second being really angry. We can apparently absorb Matt, you know, having his moments. But this team has to have Kerwin. He is the most important player. I'm no longer prepared to say best, but I am, like, he is the most important player. And they cannot absorb him having these, you know, this up and down, like not even a good game, bad game, like good half, bad half. Like it just can't function. This team needs him to be more of a rock. And if he's not going to be a rock, then it's going to continue. But if he has a second half, like he had a first half against Kansas State, we win easily. Like it's like they, you know, it's not really close, but his level dropped. He got more comfortable shooting from deep. He didn't pass very well. And he said after the game, he's like, well, if I don't have 6 turnovers and no assists, I guess we can be okay. Like, fucking, you're a senior. Like, you're a senior. Like, what are you talking about? Like, yeah, dude. Like, that's not some kind of quick thing you should learn. Like, don't have 6 turnovers to no assist in a game, man. Like, that's not okay. So and you know, he's trying hard and wants to do well, and I applaud him for it, and I love him because he's a Texas guy. But, like, we can't do that. We cannot be having that conversation with a guy that's played the minutes that he has, that has been counted on as many times as he has. It just can't freaking happen anymore, and it still is. So if there is some way that gets fixed, like if we find some way to get him locked in consistently over the next 6 games, like, okay, we can beat anybody. We can go 6-0, or we can go 2-4 if he has the same kind of mental breakdowns or mental letdowns that he had in the second half against K-State.
I'd like it noted that we had this exact same fucking conversation a year ago this time.
I was about to say. It seems like Texas every year has the guy who needs to be the rock of their team.
No. About Snoop.
Oh.
Is specifically, we had this exact conversation about him a year ago. And I hear you. Look, I thought my zone offense thing was going to be a hard fix, but good luck with that, Tim.
Yeah. I don't know if that's getting fixed anytime between now and March. But we can hope.
Sure. All he's got to do is lock in for 6 games. So it's not a whole season.
So that's going to bring me back to, like, it's been a big thing on InsideTexas.com where people have been very frustrated. Like, why did Ramey sit? Why do you sit him? And, like, so much with Shaka, and I know people are, you know, so many people are, I mean, not even on the fence. Like, you either love him or I love him. Like, you're either okay with him or you hate him. And, like, well, why? How could you possibly sit Ramey? Like, I get it. Like, I understand why you sit Ramey. The Kansas game, we're not even in that Kansas game at Lawrence without Febres. Like, we don't beat Kansas State on the road probably without Febres. We, you know, there's been a number of games where Jace has shot us back into the game. Well, why do you sit Ramey? He's shooting so well. Well, I get it. Like, we've seen Roach win us games and, like, be good down the stretch in some games. So I understand why Shaka would make the decision to have him on the floor that entire time, even though he was not playing very well, because we know what he's capable of. He hits the 3 against Arkansas, right, to send it to overtime earlier this year. And so it makes some sense. But from the same token, like, you have to wonder what our coaching staff is going through to be like, all right, Snoop, we have this game plan. We need you attacking in this way. Great first half. That's perfect, man. Good job. That's exactly what we wanted. Wait, what now? And then the second half happens. And
Wait, whoa.
No, Kerwer.
Snoop, you know, is the human embodiment of Leroy Jenkins.
At least I got chicken.
Yeah. We might have had this conversation about Roach, but it just seems like every year the guy who Texas needs to be the rock of their team is the most inconsistent player in the entire freaking league. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. To your point and to Johnny's point, I will be fascinated next year. As much as it will hurt to not have a guy that can do the things Kerwin can do, what will it mean for this team to no longer rely on him? Like, like, is the common denominator that guy? If so, that just seems really hurtful and mean for me to say. So I am a, you know, a small percentile of the athlete and capability level of that guy. So I don't want to be like, oh, well, he's not any good. Like, he's very, very good. But there is a part of me that's like, all right, when he's gone, you know, maybe we'll find some consistency.
Perhaps he's Chris Boyd. He's the Chris Boyd of the basketball team. Where everybody
possibly.
I was thinking more like Charlie Sheen leaves your house party. You're like, okay, we can all go back to what we were doing happened.
Was he the party? Was he
yeah,
the party?
Was he the party? Or was he the reason there's a tiger in the house? I don't know.
The answer to that riddle is yes.
So, yeah, exactly.
I ask you these questions because going forward, the next 6 games are going to be very important for Texas in securing either a spot in the March Madness or a spot in the NIT. Let's go ahead and kind of break down the next 6 games. And how many wins do you think Texas gets out of these next 3 games? Where do they come from?
Well, they're going to beat Oklahoma State on Saturday. Yes.
Whoa. Okay. We're coming out of the gates blazing hot.
I'd be very surprised if they didn't win that game. I think that they're going to win on the road at Baylor. I think that there's too much that we saw in that first game that Baylor just doesn't have an answer for. Baylor shot very well in that game. I thought Baylor played a pretty good offensive game, and we still beat them easily. So I see both of those as wins. Trying to think of who else we've got going on. So,
TCU,
well, I guess it's
at home. I think you have Iowa State at home, and you have Oklahoma away.
Yeah, so the games I feel pretty comfortable about. I think we're gonna beat Oklahoma State this weekend. I think we're gonna win at Baylor. So we need to find at least one win out of the next four, or the other four, at least one. To me the most likely win of that is TCU at home, maybe at OU. Iowa State. I don't think we've lost to Iowa State at home. Well, we probably did at home like. Even the year we were so bad, we beat Iowa State in Austin, I want to say.
I think we beat them in Ames that year. I think that was the
one. No, we got pooped on. I was there.
You're right. Okay, yep.
The only game that really looks to me of that whole six-game stretch is like, oh, boy, I just don't see it, is the game at Tech. Right, so like whether I think this game is more or Johnny thinks that game is more, like we'll see. But at least five of those games are somewhere between quite winnable and very winnable. It just is going to depend on how well they play, how consistent they are.
I took this from a little different angle, and I said, how would I rank the six games in terms of, you know, how winnable they are? And mm-hmm. the top one is Oklahoma State. The next one for me is at Oklahoma. And I say that because I'm still pretty sure they're going to be 3-10 and on at least a 5-6 game losing streak at that point.
Not TCU, home against, not at home at TCU.
No, that's the next one. So I think Oklahoma State, then at Oklahoma, then TCU, then at Baylor, then Iowa State at home, and then at Tech is the least likely of the six.
I feel like the jump between Iowa State at home and Tech is just. Quite a step.
It's probably. So, I mean, I guess it depends on which Iowa State team shows up. But yes, I would say that if Texas is going to have the most 2019 Texas season of all, they will lose to Oklahoma State. They will beat Tech in Lubbock. They will. They'll end up 8-10, but they'll have won against Iowa State and at Tech, but they'll lose the other four. I think 3-3 in the next six is very reasonable. 4-2 is not out of the question. They could go 5-1 if they recapture what they did in that sort of four and a half game stretch. But I'm not ready to say they're going to do that. That seems like very much best case scenario. I guess I would say 3-3 seems like the most plausible out of that six. 4-2 is definitely in the realm of possibility. I don't really see 2-4 out of that based on who they're playing at home, when they're getting each team, et cetera, et cetera. So, I guess I'm going to say they end up 9-9, 10-8. I thought 10-8, but a week ago or a few days ago, but that also meant I thought they were beating Kansas State. So I feel less confident about that possibility.
So let's go ahead and do my favorite thing in podcast and set expectations for fans.
This was going to be podcast shirtless, but all right.
Saying that, what's the least amount of wins or the worst that Texas can do and still secure a spot in the tournament, the March Madness tournament?
So I think given that I don't know how many people are, some people are aware, some people are not, of just how weak the bubble is this year. It is extraordinarily weak. Like, for example, in a normal year, the Pac-12 probably gets, 3-6 teams in on an average year, maybe 7 on a really good year. They may be a single bid team or a single bid conference this year, which means that's 2-4 spots that have opened up for other people as at large bids. You combine that with a couple of conferences like the A-10 and some others where what might have been the best resume team was behind in the conference standings is now ahead or at least tied, and they look like they might be one big leagues again. And so there's just a lot of room on the bubble, on the good side of the bubble, for a team like Texas. So I think even if they go 2-4, they're 8-10 in conference, I still think they get in based on their strength of schedule, the wins that they do have, and the fact that they're playing in the Big 12. Especially if they can put in a win or two in the Big 12 tournament, I think they're pretty easily in. I mean, you consider that before the Kansas State game, they were an 8-10 seed in almost every bracket you could find out there. And those aren't really the trouble seeds. Like 11-12 is where high major teams start to get worried about being last four in or that sort of thing. So they have room to breathe right now. And if they can win a couple of the next six, especially if they manage to pull off one against another tournament team, like say Tech or Iowa State, one of those, then I think they're probably in with some room to spare.
Yeah, 2-4 is going to be sweaty. So if we go 2-4 over the next six, like, there's going to be a lot of reasons for people to be nervous.
But 2-4 against who? Who are those two wins against?
Anybody.
Really?
Like, no matter who it is. If they're 2-4, that's like, even if they win against Iowa State and then at Tech, I still think that's going to be pretty sweaty. Like, cuz that team will be, if that's what they are, if they're 2-4, they'll be 16-15, I want to say, on the regular season. That's pretty rough. Like, I can't remember an at-large team that got in at 16-15 from the regular conference or regular season. So, you know, it's possible, but it's certain that'd be rough. 3-3 or better gets them in. I think pretty comfortably gets them in, because like Johnny says, like, the analytics are very, very much in our favor. You know, Purdue keeps on winning, Radford keeps on winning, VCU keeps on winning. You know, that win at Kansas State's going to look better and better as the year goes on.
The North Carolina win.
Yeah, so stuff like that is going to really make a difference for us as far as like, we're going to be okay. So, I, if you're looking for a worst-case scenario, I guess if they win one, I don't see any possible universe where we win none. So I guess if we win one, that'd be pretty bad.
Well, that's it. It's confirmed. We're going 0-6 now.
Yeah, there we go. It's going to happen. It's for sure.
But fucking, like, Tim made sure that Courtney Ramey got hit by a dump truck just now.
He's fucking dead. Move on. But
freeze up a scholarship.
Yeah. So it will be very Shaka Ian.
Yeah, I don't know,
Smarty Ian, I suppose, to see us go 3-3 or 2-4 against the teams that maybe, like, will help us the most, and like, we're gonna eke in. But if you're looking for expectations, I do think 3-3 is probably the most reasonable way to approach it. And I think our history with Shaka and over the last year or so has sort of proven, like, we probably will beat Iowa State, and we probably will be competitive at Tech, and we should beat Oklahoma State at home, and we'll probably steal a game somewhere else. So I feel relatively confident in saying those things, and I don't think that we've been bad enough, even in our losses, for us to look at this team and say, well, they just can't compete, they've given up, or they're not good enough. They certainly are good enough. We just, as we've been saying for the last couple of months, we need to establish some consistency, and we haven't found that yet, but the good wins have been there enough for me to feel like we're going to be able to turn it on when we have to, even though I wish we'd turn it on in a very different way, or that we'd get better wins more consistently.
I'm going to go ahead and call my shots over the next six games. They beat Oklahoma State. They lose to Oklahoma. They lose at Baylor. They beat Iowa State. They lose at Tech. And then they beat TCU. That's how you go 3-3. And that, I feel like, would be the most Texas way to go 3-3 to 2019 Texas to end the season. What do y'all think?
Man, losing at both OU and Baylor would be tough for me. Those are super winnable games. But
right,
yeah,
but you beat Iowa State at home. So,
yeah, I can appreciate that. I don't think Iowa State is some kind of juggernaut special team, but I know what you mean. And here's where I kind of go by that. Iowa State does not have a rim protector. They don't have anybody that can do that. So a team that can drive like we can against a team that does not have an interior force Like, that should be in our favor. Baylor does not have a rim protector. Like, we should be able to do that against them. Whereas a team like TCU, they do have, like, Samuel can protect the rim. Like, they've, like, some of those things as far as, like, the individual matchups, I think that we, like, it's not surprising that Iowa State will shoot poorly on the road, or that we can take advantage of a Baylor team that's still kind of figuring themselves out as the end of the year comes along. Like, so, yeah, I'm not saying you're wrong, but some of that stuff would piss me off more than others, I guess.
Well, so if we're looking at just going by Pomeroy's win probability right now, it goes Oklahoma State 85%, TCU 67%, Iowa State 53%, Oklahoma 45%, Baylor 40%, Texas Tech 25%. So I think what Will said earlier is right, that there is a pretty big gap between Texas Tech and the rest of the games. So they could go 4-2 in that, you know, and if they do that, they're 10-8 and they're in the top half of the conference, probably, you know, or at least tied for fifth.
They could also very easily go 2-4.
Yeah, if they're 2-4, yeah, they're 8-10 and they're, you know, seventh, I guess, probably, depending on how other teams do, like TCU.
Okay. Now tell me, what is the most realistic way Texas makes it into the tournament by finishing out the end of the season terribly? So, like, they beat Texas Tech and lose out. Is it possible that Texas gets still into the tournament? Or what's the worst Texas can do and still get in? Is it just a hard 2-4, like Tim was saying?
Well, so at that point, the question is, how do they do in the conference tournament? Because if they go, like, 7-11, so they go, 1-5 the rest of the way, they're 7-11, then, you know, maybe they win a couple games in the Big 12 Conference Tournament, which means that they're probably like a 6 or 7 seed. So that means they probably knock off like a Kansas State or a Texas Tech in the conference tournament. And then they get like, you know, say a Iowa State or TCU is in the next round. If they pop off a couple of those wins, then they can probably get in at 7-11. I don't want to see them test that boundary.
That's tough.
Yeah. They will become at that point, they would become absolutely the sort of dividing line between analytics versus wins and losses people, because the analytics would say, yeah, they're still top 30, 35. They should get in and, you know, say a play-in game or, you know, first four type game. And the people who value wins and losses only would be like, fuck that. They're like 16-16, you know. So it would definitely be, so it would be a really interesting debate among people as to whether or not Texas got in at that point. But yeah, I think 2-4 is probably the minimum, barring some sort of Big 12 tournament run type situation, if they go 1-5 in the next six games, who is confident they're actually going to make a run in the conference tournament in the first place? So I guess if we're looking at just regular season, 2-4 is the bare minimum, and 3-3 gets them in pretty comfortably.
Okay. The last question I want to end off here with is, give me a grade for Shaka Smart through this season so far. If you had to give him a season grade right now, what is it?
Well, a C-. And why I believe that is the case is I think that some of the things that we've been struggling with, we have literally been struggling with since November. You know, like,
yeah.
The big wins that he's gotten have been terrific. I think that there's been some stuff that has been proven that he did well. You have to congratulate him on how well Jackson has played. You have to congratulate him on the fact that Courtney is figuring it out. You have to kind of to give him some credit for the fact that he's kind of pulled Jericho Sims along, and that Jericho's coming back, that we're changing how Dylan is playing over, you know, the midway through the season. Some of those things I think is very good. But you know, the number one thing that is troubling us has been left unfixed, at least to this point. And maybe they fix it. Like, maybe we're close and that second half against Kansas State was an aberration and we're going to be better. But, We are still sitting here griping about consistency in late February or middle of February, which was exactly what we were griping about in late November or early December. So that's You know, it's tough for me to go any higher than that.
Which is exactly what we were griping about this time last year.
Yeah, but last year, at least he had a decent rationale for why it was. Like, it is extremely tough to replace what they had to replace last year. And Baum got hurt, right? So, like, you lose Andrew for the entire rest of the season. Mo gets hurt, and, you know, like, I want to say he missed, like, the last five regular season games, or at least the last three or something like that. So there was some rationale with that. This year, we have no significant injuries. This year, we didn't lose our best player to, you know, to some crazy thing. Like, the adversity has not really been there other than just, like, our own shooting ourselves in the foot by not being able to do it. So the lack of consistency this year, to me, is much more damning than it was last year where you had, like, he had a very obvious reason why that consistency was giving us problems, because our most consistent player was no longer there. Well, this year he's had his full roster essentially the entire time.
Yeah, it's, you know, if I had more time to sit here and sort of grade out each of the individual elements to come up with a good aggregate, I might come up with a better answer here. I mean, I guess I'd have to say, like, I'm sort of vacillating between a C+ and a B- kind of situation where, you know,
really,
the offense has shown.
That good?
I mean, the offense, if they finish the year off with the offensive efficiency numbers they have now, it'll be the best number since 2011. And that's not nothing based on where they were a year ago. And they have made a number of changes throughout the season to increase the effectiveness of it, to put people in the right positions offensively. You know, it's not perfect, obviously, we saw, but it is significantly better than it was before. And for the most part, their defense has remained at or nearly as good as it was. So there's that. But at the same time, Tim is right that the consistency problems are a significant issue, and that he does need to be docked for that in some way. And you know, Tim is also right about the injury issues or lack thereof. So, you know, it's very much a mixed bag, and I'm not sure where I fall on that at this point. You know, maybe I'd have a more definitive answer at the end of the year, but I guess that's sort of where I'm sitting, is like, I feel like they're closer than they've been to really getting things rolling in a couple of years, for that matter. And so I don't want to come down with some overly harsh grade when I feel like there's a lot of signs of progress that have not yet manifested in wins. And so, that's why I'm sort of at that C-B+ cutoff, somewhere right around there.
Well, I ask because I will be asking y'all again when we get to the end of the season, and I want to see how y'all's answers change from now to the end.
Yep.
But for now, I think we're going to end off there. Thank y'all for pretending we were football for the past hour. I've been your host, Will Baizer. You guys can find me on Twitter at WILLBAIZER. Johnny Brashear, where can we find you?
You can find me on Barking Carnival, telling people they're idiots. And I'm also
or Reddit,
on...
Or Discord, yeah. Or Twitter.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, I'm at Bitter White Guy everywhere, just calling people idiots. That's my hobby. when I've got 15 minutes between projects at work, I make sure to log on to one of those websites and be like, "You're a moron." And then I log off and
gargle my balls.
Yeah, gargle my balls. Yes, everybody can gargle my balls.
Johnny, while we can find you calling somebody an idiot somewhere online, where in the world is Timothy Preston?
One, 2, 3. Yeah.
So I know everybody knows that Tim is a teacher, and he's a big fan of literacy. Like, really, he likes to promote literacy wherever he can possibly promote it. And for the past couple of weeks, he's been going around Iowa handing out books to the homeless. He found an enormous cache of books from an estate sale of an elderly gentleman who collected a bunch of copies of one specific title. So if you see a bunch of homeless people walking around Cedar Rapids reading Mein Kampf, you can thank Tim Preston.
I was wondering where that was going, because A, it's been cold as fuck. So if I gave homeless people books, I'd probably be getting some pretty mean looks around here.
Where'd you get the stash, though?
Mein Kampf.
That guy prefers his privacy, and he doesn't really want to, you know,
Joni
part
Ernst.
Of the will. Yeah.
So
he's also got a really interesting collection of
Steve King. Yeah. So.
But Tim, besides handing out some pretty interesting books, we'll say interesting, where can we find you on the internet?
Those homeless people are now literate in two languages. That's not nothing.
Well, on InsideTexas.com, and then on Twitter at InsideTexasHoop, no S. Come hang out with us. Got a cool community.
And where can we find you on the basketball court?
Well, this week we only had one of our games because the other game forfeited, which is nice. It's always good to get a dub without really having to expend the energy. But in the first game, I'll tell you what. I hit some threes. I was very capable from the outside. And then once you hit some threes, like, you can kind of start probing a little bit in the defense, and they have to kind of be more honest with you. So I was able to get inside with the big boys, finish at the rim. Not above the rim, but at the rim. I think you understand. But every time I play, when I get done, every single time, every game I've ever played of basketball, just about the entire team of the other team kind of confronts me at the end and say, like, hey, man, we've come together. We've talked about this. Where you really took it to us was right in our fucking face. And I'm like, I know it.
And you guys can find us on our other shows right here on the Hornscast channel. That's the Hornscast channel on iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, Google Play, anywhere else you can find a podcast. Thank y'all for listening, and we will see y'all next week. Hook 'em.
Hook 'em. You ain't never had a friend, never had a friend. You ain't never had a friend, never had a friend. You ain't never,
ever
had a friend like me.
Yeah. You ain't never had a friend like me.
Womp.